I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. President Woodrow Wilson helped to usher in the era of progressive government and has been called an architect of modern liberalism. He's credited with creating the Federal Reserve Bank, the graduated income tax, labor laws, antitrust laws. He received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1919 after World War I. He was also a racist, whose government rolled back civil rights, including resegregating the federal workforce, with African Americans being demoted or losing their jobs or working behind screens. He wrote about the inferiority of black people, supported the KKK, and hosted a screening of Birth of a Nation at the White House. Wilson was also president of Princeton University, where a school of public policy is named after him. Students at Princeton staged a sit-in recently calling on the university to rename that building and to address Wilson's legacy on race. We begin our conversation with Truss Kapupica. She's a junior anthropology major at Princeton University, also a member of the school's Black Justice League. And Truss, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be here.
How far back has this campaign been going, looking at the legacy of Woodrow Wilson at Princeton University?
Well, we've been having this campaign for a little over a year. So it started around November of last year. And we've been doing more and more, adding different demands, but also refining the demand that we've had concerning Woodrow Wilson. And now currently it's at the point in which we're asking for very specific things like his removal, his portrait being removed from the dining hall and his name being removed from the School of Public Policy and other places such as that.
And I know part of your campaign has been to educate people at Princeton about Woodrow Wilson. Mm-hmm. How did you do that and what did you find?
We had a postering campaign. So we put various quotes by Woodrow Wilson about how he felt about African Americans, Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans, and the like. And we posted them around the school, which is very informative because a lot of people were able to read what he actually said and understand how he felt about, the students who are currently attending Princeton University. We also had a screening of Birth of a Nation on the side of the Woodrow Wilson Public Policy School, which is very interesting because many students have heard of the film but have never seen it and don't really understand what it perpetuates. So that was very informative as well. And we also have written articles in the Daily Princetonian, which is a newspaper on campus. So we've done a lot in trying to inform different students about Woodrow Wilson's legacy.
And did you find that students there and perhaps even faculty there didn't know the full history, the full story of Woodrow Wilson?
Yes, we found that students and faculty strikingly were unaware of Wilson's full legacy. And I think that's due in part to the fact that we don't really challenge any of the names on our buildings or any of the presences that we see on campus, whether it's the portraits of the multiple previous alumni or students at Princeton University. And we have a lot of settings in which we have their portraits up, and we have buildings named after them, and we have statues commemorating them. But there is really no place on campus in which we have conversations about who these people were in full.
And what has been the response of the university, and specifically the president of the university, Ice Gruber?
The university, just in how it's set up, is slow to change. And that makes sense because they want to take precautions that they're moving in the right direction. But I feel like the response of the university has been fairly split. There have been faculty and students who feel that his removal is something that is plausible, whereas others feel that in changing or removing his name, it's sort of revising history and erasing the very valuable contributions that Wilson gave to this nation, but also Princeton University.
Let me quote something that the president said. He said, "I agree with you," and this is you meaning the Black Justice League at Princeton University. Mm-hmm. "I agree with you. Woodrow Wilson was a racist. The right way to approach Wilson is to acknowledge what is good about him and what is terrible about him." Does that address the kind of concerns that you have, Trust?
It addresses part of it, but I think another part that is being lost is having a conversation also about who we choose to commemorate on this campus. So in conversations with President Eisgruber, we did mention that there are multiple Princeton alumni and multiple people who have had valuable impact on Princeton's campus who did not hold similar views as Wilson, and that, yes, we have to have conversations about the full character and legacy of Woodrow Wilson, but we also have to consider as a university who we are choosing to commemorate in the first place, and those people usually happen to be white, upper-class men. And that's also a very large problem that we have with the continued commemoration of Woodrow Wilson and others who look very similar to Woodrow Wilson.
And I do want to pick up on that, but I also read that the president of Princeton seems to agree that the mural of the president is going to mm-hmm. be removed from the college's dining room. Is that correct?
Yes, he does agree with that position. He said so himself, and he is helping us to go move through the processes of getting that done. I think the point that's more contentious is the renaming of the public policy school and also the renaming of the residential college. But the removing of the mural is something that President Eisgruber, he understands and agrees with.
And you want the name of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Policy, International Affairs, or I forget the exact name that's used there. You want that name, what, erased, taken off the building?
We have, when at the table with President Eisgruber, we were willing to come up with different solutions. So we do not want to erase history and erase his name if we can, as a university, honestly construct a representation of Wilson that reveals more fully his legacy and character. So we suggested maybe having a plaque that also talks about the negative contributions Wilson gave, or we could have meetings in which conversations are had at the beginning of the year, or something that facilitates dialogue. We're very open to different solutions, but what we've noticed on campus is that we can have whole buildings and residential colleges named after Wilson and have his portrait everywhere, and there are no spaces on campus that facilitate any sort of dialogue or even recognize the fact that he may have been detrimental to an entire population of students, specifically Black students, who are currently at this campus and have to deal with the fact that Princeton University lionizes those who did not even want us here.
Well, and it's interesting that you've come up with what sounds like a compromise. So the willingness to leave his name on certain buildings, but to make sure that students there, faculty, perhaps visitors, parents, have the full picture of who this man was, would that satisfy you and other members of the Black Justice League then?
I believe that it's all very specific depending on which building. I think for buildings like the residential college, I personally feel like these buildings, if, let's say, the person who they're named after gave a significant amount of funds to the university to have a building name or something along that line, mm-hmm. then that conversation is definitely one that we're willing to have. But I think in the case of Woodrow Wilson, because his name is on the School for Public Policy and International Affairs, I think the university needs to be a little bit more careful about leaving his name on the building because of the impact his public policy had on Black people and people of color.
I know you have some other, I don't know if list of demands is too strong, but there's some other things you want, including some cultural competency for students and faculties. What would that involve?
Well, cultural competency training for the faculty, staff, and preceptors will look a little bit different than the cultural competency requirement, or also known as the academic diversity requirement for the students. But as for the faculty, staff, and preceptors, we were hoping that just as faculty and staff have to go through training to learn about how not to perpetuate certain incorrect ideologies, like in concern to sexual assault and things of that nature. So faculty do have to go through a particular training for particular issues that I believe are federally mandated. But we had hoped that we could add to that a training on diversity, not only in race, but socioeconomic class and in gender and gender identity, because we've been in classes or in spaces in which professors have perpetuated incorrect and oftentimes racist ideologies. And as sometimes as being the only Black student in the class, it's an uncomfortable and sometimes unsafe space, because when in discussions with President Eisgruber, he had suggested that when we approach faculty who say something racist, that the only real consequence of their actions is that they'll have to be forced to challenge their views, because they'll be forced into conversation with us. But the burden of challenging faculty as a Black student and knowing that our grades depend on faculty's opinions of us, and also knowing that it's intimidating to try to correct faculty, we as students wouldn't want to do that. We would want the university to have some sort of cultural competency training for the faculty and staff, so that we as students could be more comfortable in our classrooms and in our precepts.
And in just a couple minutes before I have to say goodbye to you, you've also called for a Black affinity housing. Would that be housing specifically for Black students at Princeton?
No, Black affinity housing, we chose to look at schools like Yale and Stanford, I believe, that have housing for those who are interested in Black culture. And that'd be very similar to the Edwards Art Collective, which we already have on campus, in which students who are interested in the arts can opt into living on the third, fourth, and fifth floors of the Edwards building on campus. So we would just have that for those who are interested in Black culture, which could mean Black students or any student, actually, like, who's interested in Black culture could opt into Black affinity housing.
And do you feel, as an African-American student at Princeton, that you are accepted at that university?
No, not necessarily. I feel like because of my identity as being Black and also being a woman and other intersectional identities, but just as being African-American, I found a lot of the systems in place aren't set up to deal with my particular set of problems. So another, just a quick example, is that we have a counseling and psychological services on campus. And it's found that a lot of the people who use those services are people of color or Black people, but a lot of the staff in McCosh Health Center, which is what it's called, are not people of color. And when we go to talk to, let's say, a counselor about racial trauma or issues that we have concerning our race, and I know I've gone myself, it's not really understood, because most of them have not really approached race from a personal standpoint, so they don't really understand how to offer counseling to Black students and people of color.
Well, Truss Kapubica, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, getting our conversation started. Thanks so much.
Okay. No problem. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Junior anthropology major at Princeton University, a member of the school's Black Justice League, getting our conversation started as we talk about the racial or racist legacy of Woodrow Wilson. And we have two guests waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're discussing the legacy of Woodrow Wilson as the head of Princeton University, also as president of the United States, some of the implications of removing his name and likeness from the campus, as some are calling for from Princeton University, as we just heard from our first guest. Let me introduce our other two guests who happen to both be professors or be teaching at New York University. Joining us by telephone, Nathan Connolly, visiting associate professor of history at New York University, wrote a book called A World More Concrete, Real Estate in the Remaking of Jim Crow South Florida. Nathan Connolly, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Thanks.
You're so welcome. And with us here in our Philadelphia studio is Jonathan Zimmerman, professor of education and history at New York University. And Jonathan Zimmerman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So you're so welcome. And what's so interesting to me, and perhaps we can put Woodrow Wilson into a class by himself, as a number of colleges wrestle with some of the legacy of their founders, of their presidents, because he was the president of Princeton University, I'm looking at you, Jonathan, and also president of the United States. This was a man who had the authority to do extraordinary things in those two positions.
Oh, absolutely. And a key architect of the modern state and of this thing we call progressivism. the progressive movement. So Wilson was an absolutely seminal figure, not just in the history of the university, but in the history of the United States.
But I actually tweeted this. Can we call him a progressive racist?
Absolutely, because almost all of the progressives were racist in the sense that we would mean that term. Racial ideologies colored almost everything they did in and wrote. And in that regard, it strikes me Wilson is no different. One could say that perhaps some of his racism was more egregious. But it's interesting, you know, a lot of the people who have been complaining about Wilson's racism are on the right. They have names like Glenn Beck and Paul Ryan. And they've also pointed out, and I would say correctly, that Margaret Sanger, one of the leading progressive women and indeed the foremother of modern contraceptive services and Planned Parenthood, herself had ideas that were eugenic and racist, and they're correct about that.
Well, let me turn to you, Nathan. I guess the question is, where do we put Woodrow Wilson? Was he just a man of his time? Was he a more ardent or extreme segregationist or even racist of his time?
Well, it's interesting to think about Trust's Kopubica's concerns as a student, right, and what it means to be kind of on these campuses and in these institutions that are literally birthed in the Jim Crow era. I mean, I think it's really important to look at our kind of college campuses and again, Woodrow Wilson as a person, as being a very real product of the Jim Crow era and the politics that it engendered. I mean, Wilson was born before the Civil War, right? And he was a Confederate. He was sympathetic to the goals of the Confederacy. And as much as it's important to talk about him as being an architect of modern liberalism, it actually does then invite us to think about liberalism as being an echo in some critical respects of the Confederacy and of Confederate-era politics. I mean, the thing about Wilson that's so critical, if you think, for instance, about the segregation of the civil service, of the federal employees in 1913, he's making arguments in favor of that move that are coming directly out of the logic of Plessy versus Ferguson, right? He's trying to draw a distinction between what they consider to be civil rights and political rights. And there's no actual discrimination involved in the Jim Crow move politically, unless African Americans choose to put that formulation on it. Separate can in fact be equal, and in instituting segregation across the federal bureaucracy is a way of maintaining the racial peace and ultimately leading to a much more efficient and better working federal government. I mean, that really was his argument. And people at the time, you know, one could certainly suggest, made that argument disingenuously, right? I mean, there's a lot that goes into policing the color line on an everyday basis, and certainly the experiences of black federal employees who suffered demotions, who lost property because they couldn't afford to pay for their basic cost of living. I mean, there are really compelling narratives that have come out of this kind of Wilson debate that are really putting a face on the folks who were, in fact, discriminated against. And so I think it's critical to think about Wilson as absolutely being an echo or an extension of existing politics, but also I think to lay a significant amount of the conversation at his feet, because frankly, he was in a position as an administrator, as an intellectual, as a scholar, to make different kinds of choices in the context of Jim Crow America.
I ran across a number of quotes, as one can imagine, preparing for a show like this. And Jonathan, one of the ones that he said, I think, in defense of the kind of resegregation that happened when he became the president, segregation is not a humiliation, but a benefit. I mean, from his perspective, and yes, he was born before the Civil War, he was president in the 20th century. Civil rights legislation had been in effect for some time at that point. And he didn't intervene as they were rolled back.
Absolutely. And I think that Nathan's absolutely right. I mean, I think that the comment very much comes out of and echoes that the logic, such as it was, of Plessy v. Ferguson. But, you know, I also think it's really important to emphasize that, you know, Wilson also created during his presidencies structures and indeed states that would eventually help assist the least fortunate members of the United States, including some members of minority communities.
But that was not his intention, though.
Not at all, not in the least. Quite to the contrary. But I think one of the things that history teaches us is that history has ironic outcomes and unintended ones. But it is important to emphasize that one of the reasons people on the right, like Glenn Beck, want to attack Woodrow Wilson isn't just because of his racism. They're absolutely correct about that. They're trying to stigmatize progressivism as a whole and indeed trying to stigmatize the state. Just like in seizing upon the racism of Margaret Sanger, what they're trying to do is to stigmatize Planned Parenthood and government assistance for birth control services.
Now, Nathan, go ahead.
Yeah, please. I think this is a great point on which to really hammer it home that, you know, so much of this debate is absolutely a product of contemporary political concerns, right? And of debates between conservatives and liberals, you know, Democrats and Republicans about what to do about the Jim Crow era. And on some level, I think it's really necessary to, you know, again, acknowledge that these kinds of terms, like liberal versus conservative, don't really translate too well across the years, right? I mean, one could certainly argue that a lot of what Wilson is advocating for in the 19-teens is really being echoed by the Republican Party after the 1970s, right? That you don't really need state interventions to try to create comity between the so-called races, right? I mean, Wilson is very much believing that, you know, if you institute segregation, the federal government shouldn't really be involved in, you know, making desegregation or forcing desegregation onto people or getting people out of their so-called natural behaviors or their personal preferences, right? I mean, that's certainly a kind of similarity to contemporary right-wing politics. And so on the one hand, it kind of puts folks in a bind, right, because it forces liberals or people on the center left to have to offer, in some cases, very tepid defenses of Woodrow Wilson when the response may better be actually to double down on the critique and say, you know what? What we in fact need are better federal enforcements of civil rights laws that are already on the books. We need to break from the tradition of Wilson in terms of believing that civil rights or racial justice will simply happen without kind of robust federal and, again, deliberately racially inflected social policy. And that we need to, in some cases, think even more broadly about our foreign policy and say, you know, our foreign policy from a right-wing standpoint is much more akin to what Wilson advocated for, right? A certain kind of neglect of non-white nations. I mean, Wilson was not an advocate for self-determination among colonized countries or countries of color. His position on Haiti is well known in terms of the U.S. occupation he helped to orchestrate in 1915. And so we have to, in some cases, think about, you know, the kind of Wilsonian world as having moved across party lines, or at least being one that is owned in a bipartisan fashion.
And that's Nathan Connelly, visiting associate professor of history at New York University. Also with us, Jonathan Zimmerman, professor of education and history at New York University as well. We are talking about Woodrow Wilson, president of both the United States and of Princeton University. There are some calls at Princeton University to remove his name, or certainly may put up some of the less laudatory parts of his past, of his belief system. And you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times with your questions and your comments. Let me just be really concrete here, though. I mean, there's a question, and you two have an advantage in that you don't teach at Princeton University, but this is happening on other campuses as well. And sort of once you know, whether you're a student, you're a faculty, or maybe the president of a university, once this information is out there in the public, then a university has to decide, what do we do about this? What do we do about a person that, yes, they were the president, in this case, of Princeton University. They have this progressive legacy. They also have this racist legacy. What do we do about a building or an institution that is named after this person? And as I said, it's happening on other campuses as well. Jonathan, I'm looking at you.
Well, look, I think that one of the things we do is what we're doing right now is have a conversation about it. And I think that's the most salutary thing that's come out of these past couple of weeks at Princeton and other places, is a really in-depth embrace and examination of the complicated legacy of these figures. And when I say figures, I'm not just talking about Wilson. Let's look at Princeton. Martha Sandweiss, who teaches there, she had her students dig into the history of the institution, and they found out that the first eight presidents owned slaves. the first eight presidents of Princeton. I mean, one of the biggest myths about American history is that slavery was a Southern institution. Of course, it was primarily a Southern institution and numerically so, but not exclusively, especially during the colonial era. So the first eight gentlemen who were presidents of Princeton owned human beings. I think it's really important for everybody at Princeton, indeed everybody in the United States, to know that. Wilson is not alone in this.
But he is, as I said, a 20th century figure. Yes, born in the 19th century, a 20th century figure. I remember going to Monticello and, you know, being inspired but also very troubled by what happened at Monticello. One can sort of half excuse it, I guess, if you say, well, you know, they didn't know any better, although I'm on very thin ice.
I always bridle at that. And I, whenever my students tell me, well, that's what people thought, I always say, which people? And Wilson provides a good example of that, because African-Americans like Du Bois and Trotter were criticizing Wilson during all the events that Nathan was chronicling. So is it probably true that most Americans or most white Americans kind of ignored this or blithely accepted this? That's probably true. But people qua people, it's not true. There were opponents of it, including African-American opponents, who were fully aware of what Wilson was doing and were blasting it. But I would like to emphasize that by the time of the New Deal, this liberalism that Nathan was talking about has become quite popular electorally among African-Americans. There is a reason that by the 1930s, three-quarters of African-Americans were voting Democrat, and there's a reason that over 90% of them vote Democrat today.
And that's because of progressives like Woodrow Wilson, like FDR? Like...
I would say because of the progressive legacy, however imperfect, however racially biased.
Nathan. Hold on. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Nathan.
Okay, so this is actually a great example of how we can think about kind of legacies, again, in race and liberalism, right? Because it's absolutely the case that FDR was instrumental in building on the foundation of an important kind of set of safety nets that Wilson helped to lay. But we cannot ignore the fact that he also built on the segregationist foundation that Wilson helped to lay, right? The Federal Housing Administration's housing policies, as has been well documented, were probably the most effective segregationist program in American history, full stop. And those were created on Roosevelt's watch as part of the New Deal. Mass segregation of real estate on a level that we had never seen in the Old South, right, to be very clear. Secondly, you know, Roosevelt's own kind of electoral popularity among African Americans is an extraordinarily complicated story. He was not popular in the election of 1932 precisely because people were able to link him to Woodrow Wilson. Franklin Roosevelt was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy during the U.S. occupation of Haiti. He bragged in 1920 of actually writing on his own the Constitution for the nation of Haiti, unilaterally just creating this document. And believe it or not, it was the Republican National Committee that publicized this among black voters and created, if not on its own, a kind of tepid response, certainly helped to exacerbate what was already a very bad reputation that Roosevelt had among black voters. Now, I would certainly concede that by 36, after the programs of the New Deal got going and after a number of African Americans got work relief and other kinds of protections, there was reason to be putting your kind of vote in the Roosevelt column.
71%. 71% of African Americans.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that 71% is an extension as much of Republican apathy as it is of Democratic fervence on the black vote. But the last thing I think, just to kind of connect the dots, is we should not draw a kind of clear divide between the 19th and the 20th century, right, between the era of slavery and the more kind of contemporary world that Wilson and Roosevelt et al. Helped to create. And again, Wilson is someone who personally kind of transgressed that boundary. But I've always am amazed to think about in 1923, the U.S. Senate approved to build a monument to the Mammy on the National Mall or in Washington, D.C., actually off Massachusetts Avenue. And they claim, and I'm quoting now, this was supposed to be in memory of the faithful slave mammies of the South, unquote. That was in 1923. And so if the U.S. Senate could see fit to try to commemorate the Mammy figure, and again, the faithful slave in 1923, I think we certainly can have a conversation about other kinds of statuary that might, one, note or remark on the history of slavery, certainly on the Princeton campus, remark on the U.S. occupation in Haiti, perhaps build an even larger monument to honor the federal employees who were demoted from their jobs on Wilson's watch. All of these markers, I think, might help to change the way in which we inhabit this kind of landscape of commemoration.
More monuments, Jonathan Zimmerman.
Look, I agree with all of that, and I yield to nobody in my admiration for the way that Nathan and others have chronicled all of this racism that the state perpetuated, right? But I think it's really important that we not allow the racial origins and racist origins of many of these structures to invalidate or delegitimize those structures today, because that's what politicians like Paul Ryan and Glenn Beck are trying to do. And I would go back to the Margaret Sanger example. Yes, Sanger was a eugenicist. Sanger was asked the purpose of birth control. She said, more from the fit, less from the unfit. Mm-hmm. That's the purpose of birth control. Now, it seems to me we should take that very seriously, and we should use that to scrutinize the degree to which current-day family planning programs in this country and around the world might embody a legacy of eugenics, right? We should not in any way ignore this. But by the same token, we shouldn't allow it to invalidate all of the important programs that organizations like Planned Parenthood do today, which is precisely what people on the right are trying to use that to do.
And we're almost up in a break here. What I hear both of you saying, I'll toss this to you, Jonathan, is that we have to take people off of pedestals. I mean,
Absolutely. We do.
It seems like we do a lot of that. I don't know if we're unique in the world, but we certainly do that with our leaders, or some of our leaders anyway.
Indeed. I mean, the whole idea of a hero or heroine, unfortunately, I think in the popular connotation, means somebody that we exempt from critical analysis. And that's an enormous mistake, because as citizens, we need the opposite. We need to embrace them in all their complexity and in their contradictions.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Jonathan Zimmerman, professor of education and history at New York University, joining us by telephone. Nathan Connolly, he's a visiting associate professor of history at New York University, wrote a book called A World More Concrete, Real Estate and the Remaking of Jim Crow South Florida. We're talking about the legacy of Woodrow Wilson, both as president at Princeton University and as president of the United States, and the host of questions raised by our complicated leaders in this country. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Nathan Connolly and Jonathan Zimmerman about President Woodrow Wilson, president of both Princeton University and the United States, talking about his legacy of progressive politics, also about the fact that he was a racist, and there's some efforts at Princeton University to struggle and deal with some of that racist legacy. And you can join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read something else I ran across. Now, this goes back to 1901. Woodrow Wilson wrote an article for the Atlantic Monthly titled The Reconstruction of the Southern States, talking about Reconstruction. And this is just one very long sentence. He writes, here was a vast, laboring, landless, homeless class, once slaves, now free, unpracticed in liberty, unschooled in self-control, never sobered by the discipline of self-support, never established in any habit of prudence, excited by a freedom they did not understand, exalted by false hopes, bewildered and without leaders, and yet insolent and aggressive, sick of work, covetous of pleasure, a host of dusky children, untimely put out of school. They were a danger to themselves as well as those whom they had once served. Of course, those were the slave masters. And I guess I'll toss this back to you, Nathan, which is, how do we wrestle with those ideas, those beliefs?
I think it's exactly about doing what you just did, which is to engage the ideas as ideas, right? I mean, I think it's easy to say that this or that government agency that might have emerged during the Jim Crow era needs to be completely, you know, dismantled, and that's the wrong way to go. But instead, to do what you've done, which is to excavate what the ideas are and to really look at where those kinds of ideas are made manifest. Where, for instance, are people still making arguments about the unfitness of black people to govern themselves, right? And to think about that as being not just a domestic policy or critique of Reconstruction, but also to think about that as being a critique of populations around the world that might not be a part of what we consider to be Western civilization. I mean, Wilson was an intellectual. He was a historian. D.W. Griffith is using Wilson's scholarship in Birth of a Nation, literally having screenshots of quotes from Wilson's writings. I think one of the great services that we can do as scholars is to help to remind Americans about what the actual ideas were and how those ideas moved from one different from one population to another, from one set of interest groups to another, and really try to root out anywhere where we find those kinds of ideas. Again, I think this is really critical, right? If you have an effort to erase Wilson's name, I think it's much more important to actually, or at least to accompany that effort with erasing Wilson's ideology, wherever we might find that, however it might express itself. And that requires a lot more kind of organization and consistency. And I wouldn't say to do that in place of changing how the physical environment of the schools or our government buildings is represented, but it's a necessary piece to really look at the ideas and to try to find a way to change the impact, the contemporary impact of those ideas. I mean, Jonathan and I completely agree on this front, that there are very dangerous positions that people have toward government or toward the ability of protecting individual citizens with the help of the federal government. All I would add to that is to say that people's understanding of the federal government has drastically changed in direct relation to how well that government was serving the needs of black people, right? And we have to really be aware of that so much of what the Glenn Becks and the Paul Ryans are inheriting is an abandonment of the Democratic Party in the 1960s, a certain kind of free market ideology that once the state gets in the way, it creates all kinds of unnatural associations, right? This is, again, an echo of Jim Crow era politics. And so we need to think about the fluidity of people's own understandings of government from Wilson through Roosevelt, through Lyndon Johnson, right up through Barack Obama, and know that so much of the anger about federal overreach necessarily is really about civil rights. It's really about kind of, again, black governance, which is an absolute extension of Reconstruction era fears among whites like Woodrow Wilson.
Let me get you back in. Go ahead, Jonathan. I know you want to say.
Well, no, I was just going to say that I agree with almost all of that, but I guess one concern I have is that if we start scrubbing the names, we won't engage in the ideological analysis that Nathan's asking for. Mm-hmm. You know, that is, the whole reason we're even talking about Wilson's ideology is that his names are there.
Right.
And so as a historian, I'm deeply uncomfortable with scrubbing anything. If, as the very eloquent student speaker suggested, we want to add certain plaques or quotes or records, I'm all for that. But removal, I think if you're a historian, that's anathema.
Hold on, Nathan. Just let me just throw something else in because I was thinking there's a debate to throw Andrew Jackson off the $20 bill, the renaming of Mount McKinley. And I guess the question is, let me toss this back to you, Jonathan, but also to you, Nathan, which is, where do we, if we need to do that, if erasure is the goal, and perhaps you don't believe that, Jonathan, but I mean, at some point, does someone lose their right to be on a $20 bill?
Well, look, he doesn't have any right to be on the $20 bill. That's a collective decision, right? But I would oppose it. Just like I oppose, closing Stone Mountain in Georgia, which is kind of the Confederate Rushmore. I mean, that's a really important monument. And it's not just a monument to those Confederate leaders. It's a monument to the way that white people constructed a certain version of the South. We have to remember that. And if we take away Stone Mountain, we'll forget it. So by all means, criticize everything Woodrow Wilson did, negative, and address the positive as well. But don't remove his name, because then the discussion we need becomes less likely, not more likely.
Nathan, you want to weigh in on that? And then I do want to get some callers. I've got some comments as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I made the comment in the New York Times, I guess it was yesterday, that we certainly need to not necessarily, remove the racist from the story, but actually just add a narrative about race and segregation to our dominant American history. Again, that story that we're telling ourselves about the country. But all I would say, I would agree that erasure of the names is not necessarily even at the front of our kind of to-do list, right? But I think it's also worthwhile noting, just for the sake of argument, the ubiquity of these symbols, right? The ubiquity of white nationalist iconography across the country. And we can pull a Confederate flag down over, you know, the state capitol in South Carolina, or we can question, you know, Wilson's name on the public policy school at Princeton or on a major kind of government, on a major institute in Washington, D.C. And I think those are, I mean, again, to echo Jonathan's point, valid points of debate. But I think it's also, you know, critical to say we can continue to add statuary as much as we want, or, you know, in some ways kind of block the sun from some of these monuments with bigger monuments commemorating a much more kind of multicultural and non-white America, to the extent that we believe that that's the way we should go. But I think it's also just critical to really acknowledge for a moment just how ubiquitous these symbols really are, and how many buildings do we need named after Woodrow Wilson? How many monuments do we need to Andrew Jackson? I mean, we don't even have a single monument to slavery in the country in any kind of, you know, way that would allow the country to come to terms with that legacy. And yet we have monuments to slave masters of various kinds all over the place, right? And so I think it's just, I mean, I'm not saying we have a kind of quota for how many monuments we need, but I do think it's important to at least acknowledge that we are inundated with the iconography of white great fathers. And we need to at least question that as part of these conversations.
Let me get some callers in. We've got Mike from Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Great conversation.
Thank you.
Just as a comment. You know, it's interesting, and I understand it's a major conflict. The legacy of Wilson is obviously is the issue, but I don't. My biggest concern is what he did to maintain freedom in the United States, throughout the world possibly, was pretty important. And I'm wondering if maybe an education, an increase in education to the negatives that he did put in place might be a better way than scrubbing a lot of the negatives that he did implement.
Well, Mike, in many ways, that's
I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. I'm just saying, in many ways, that's sort of what our guests are saying here, which is that they don't necessarily want to erase or sort of purge the name of Woodrow Wilson, but to be more inclusive. I'm looking at you, Jonathan.
Absolutely. And frankly, I would say, Mike, and thanks for the call, you know, it's certainly open to debate whether he was, in fact, protector of freedom during the First World War, because one of the things he did was he instituted all kinds of very draconian restrictions on free speech within this country. And then at the Paris Peace Conference, he and his representative also blocked a Japanese proposal to include racial equality in the covenant of the League of Nations. Again, none of this takes away from the heroism of the soldiers that fought on the American side in the First World War, or the other ideals of the League of Nations. It just, again, complicates the tale.
An email from Corey. I'll toss this to you, Nathan. He says, I wonder if the discussion to remove the likeness of Wilson from Princeton's campus will expand to other facilities, such as Woodrow Wilson High School in Camden, New Jersey, a city with a lot of African Americans and other minorities. And I guess the question, you know, is there a point which you draw the line, or you just sort of learn to live with these complicated and in some cases infuriating people, Nathan?
Right. So this is really an interesting question. Again, the kind of slippery slope concerns, right? And I think it's important to at least, you know, mention that campus protests are really curricular protests, right? I mean, again, I think your student who was on earlier, you know, it's not insignificant that she was talking about a certain kind of racial literacy that's necessary among the Princeton faculty and staff as part of this effort to revisit the legacy of Wilson, you know, because if you have a Woodrow Wilson High School, it's one thing, but what exactly are they being taught in the curriculum about Thanksgiving, about westward expansion, about U.S. engagements with foreign countries abroad, again, about Woodrow Wilson or George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, right? I mean, these are, in so many respects, you know, the much more kind of meaty, or one could say even attendant conversations in that, you know, the iconography on the buildings really is an extension of the curriculum. And again, this is why it's so critical to look at Wilson as the historian, right? Wilson as an architect of the Western Civ curriculum and highlighting the accomplishments of Greeks and Latins and Teutons and Celts, and at the exclusion of people of so-called, you know, African descent, right? I mean, this is all part of the same kind of conversation and conflict. And I think what you're seeing in terms of some of the pushback is really an acknowledgement of the fact that there's a relationship between the curriculum and the commemoration. That the real concern is about actually changing the textbooks, changing the narrative, making certain kinds of requirements, you know, making certain kinds of population central to kind of core liberal studies or even science education. I mean, this is all wrapped up in a seemingly, you know, kind of trivial conversation about names on buildings and marble.
Well, and go ahead, Jonathan, and then we'll get back
to I just want to emphasize, though, that part of the grappling of this legacy has to include progressivism itself, and we haven't really spoken about that. I mean, progressivism was a mass movement to try to build up a state at every level, local, state, and federal, to help ameliorate the worst consequences of the Industrial Revolution. You had pockets of wealth, but enormous pockets of poverty, and you had people living in tenements and people dying in factories and on the railroad. And the Progressive Revolution was to try to create a state, not to, you know, take over private property or any of the ridiculous charges that are made against it, but to try to regulate business and regulate the society in the public interest. And that, too, was a legacy of Wilson. And it is a legacy that's under challenge, under massive challenge today. Just take the Federal Reserve, for example. This is one of the great progressive legacies of Woodrow Wilson, a classic progressive maneuver. Before the Federal Reserve system, banking essentially was subject to the vagaries of the business cycle and also to all sorts of malfeasance by financiers. So Wilson created a new arm of the state, essentially a bank for banks that would regulate the money supply and interest rates in the public interest. Yeah. Now, look, you can argue about certain policies that the Fed has and whether they have indeed served that public interest. Right. But you got to understand that, you know, in the most recent polls, Senator Cruz is in the lead now in Iowa, and he says we shouldn't have the Fed. And when Glenn Beck and Paul Ryan rag on Woodrow Wilson, one of the things they come back to is the Fed itself. That is part of Wilson's legacy. We should not forget it, even as we remember the racist part of that legacy.
And I'm looking at the clock here. And let me just say that yesterday marked the 60th anniversary of Rosa Parks' refusal to move to the back of the bus. We posted something on our Facebook page basically thanking her for doing what she did. But and I'm back to you, Nathan, and almost out of time here. But, you know, in terms of commemorating other people, we've been focusing on Woodrow Wilson for all the obvious reasons. But, I mean, there's so many people in this country. Hopefully people know about Rosa Parks, but perhaps unsung heroes or heroines of civil rights and of other parts of our history that we really don't know about.
Absolutely. I mean, this is certainly one of the most kind of compelling arguments for, you know, again, additional monuments, additional statuary, you know, renaming some of the buildings on American campuses with a great deal of purpose. You know, I think, you know, there's absolutely a relationship between, you know, these kind of institutions of higher education and the way that we create these narratives as a country and as a whole. And so in some cases, you know, the campus protests are an effort to try to move the conversation for all of us, right? So if there's a way to get, you know, Paul Robeson's name put on Princeton University's campus as a kind of Princeton City native, right? I mean, the Paul Robeson School of Foreign Relations and Public Policy might be an interesting amendment to the Wilson question. Obviously not a great fit, but you get the idea that you can, in some cases, swap in figures who might be slightly more democratic, and I mean in the small d sense. And, you know, this can certainly be at least part of the conversation, adding statues, but also thinking about appropriate replacements as needed.
Jonathan, final thoughts?
And I just want to say, with respect to Princeton itself, I mean, while Wilson's racial legacy with respect to Princeton is appalling, he wouldn't let black students go there. Actually, his record as the president of Princeton is very complicated, and there were some incredibly salutary things that he did. He hired the first Jewish and Catholic faculty members who had been barred before that time, and he took on the Eden Clubs unsuccessfully. He said the Eden Clubs were bastions of elitism, which, by the way, they were and arguably are, and he failed in that because the alums were too strong.
Well, my thanks to both of you for giving us a lot to talk about and think about. Jonathan Zimmerman, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times once again.
Thanks. It was fun.
And he's professor of education and history at New York University. Nathan Connelly, thank you for joining us as well.
So nice to be here, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Visiting associate professor of history also at New York University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back with Hour 2.